You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's estimated that over 4 million babies will be born in the United States this year, and most of them will be screened in traditional ways for several dozen serious but treatable conditions like hearing loss, congenital heart defects, and sickle cell anemia. But what if it were possible for parents to get a full, comprehensive DNA test performed on their children? And what would it mean if those tests could point out variations in the child's genome that might indicate future medical problems? In her latest article in this past Sunday's New York Times, The Path to Reading a Newborn's DNA Map, Anne Eisenberg discusses the new technology that will make DNA screening of newborns a reality and its social, ethical, and legal implications. And she joins us now, along with Dr. Edward McCabe, the physician in chief of the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, and the chief medical officer of the March of Dimes, and Dr. Robert Klitzman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to our show. And newborn screening varies from state to state, doesn't it? But doesn't federal law require testing for 21 disorders?
It's roughly two dozen. It goes up and down according to the state. These are all public health state-mandated programs, and they're widely admired, the newborn screening programs.
Well, how is the reading of DNA of a newborn different from what's already taking place?
They're mainly blood tests, and there is a little bit of genetic screening for the confirmation of cystic fibrosis. This is quite different, though, what is being proposed. The thought in the National Institute of Health was that since genomic screening is going to become a possibility and probably economically possible. Right now, a whole genome costs $2,000 to $2,500, and a whole exome screening, that's the 1.5% of the genome that codes for proteins, is $1,000. But the prices are expected to become less, so that it is thought, in the same way children now have blood tests, they would have a cold genome screening in a few years.
And you say in a few years. The technology there now?
No. It is expected that within 10 years the technology will have dropped and it will be there. And the NIH, well, this is what I thought was so interesting. They said since it is cutting-edge technology, we should be prepared for the technology when it is inexpensive enough for us to use it. And that's what caught my mind, because usually we catch up afterwards. And as you'll be hearing from one of their doctors who was on the planning commission, they spent a couple of years working out how this might be that they could plan for something that will probably change how we diagnose newborns. Right now we diagnose for about two dozen disorders, but it is really very possible, said Dr. Eric Green, who's the head of the National Institute, that we'll be diagnosing for hundreds.
But how different is this than the current tests that look for higher risk of cancer or certain types of cancer?
They will be looking, yes, it's quite different. There's a thing called pre-symptomatic cancer that is in, for instance, children 0 to about 6, and if with an expression of proteins. And this could be looked at, and a child might be diagnosed for it and treated even before the symptoms all appeared. This sounds idealistic, but actually there are people working on it. That's the kind of person who's being supported now by the NIH grants.
And Dr. McCabe, you were active in the NIH's awarding of $5 million in grants to research the implications of this technology?
Well, I was part of a planning committee, so that before the NIH puts out a grant, a request for an application for grants, they put together a group of individuals who consider what should the scope of this grant be. And I think it was important that they listened to what the committee said, and they said, okay, we'll look at it technically, but also it's very important that we look at the ethical, legal, and social implications. You can't separate them. And how do we get this mammoth amount of information, 3 billion base pairs of DNA sequence, how do we get that back to the family and to the treating physician in a way that makes sense?
Have ethical problems been included in these kinds of plans in the past?
Yes, it was always part of the Human Genome Project that there be these ethical, legal, and social implications. And in fact, Dr. Klitzman is involved in a center that looks at
this. I was just going to ask him about that. What are the social and ethical issues that this raises, Dr. Klitzman?
Well, on the one hand, we can imagine that some parents will say, I want to know all the information about my infant. Just give it to me. I'll deal with it. And yet, on the other hand, we know, and many of us are concerned, that if parents get information that, say, suggests that a child may have a double the risk of autism, which means maybe going from a 5% to a 10% chance that or of other diseases where we may get these relative risks, those parents may become overly anxious, overly protective. They may say, I don't want Johnny playing. I want Johnny doing this. And so there are the rights of the child to have a normal childhood versus the parents wanting to say, give me everything.
And then people have often expressed concerns that knowing this sort of thing could hurt you, your future employment and insurance options, although I wonder whether Obamacare eliminates some of the insurance concerns.
Not entirely, unfortunately. So there is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, or GINA, from the late 1990s that protects people in their health insurance but does not protect them against discrimination if they want life insurance or disability insurance or long-term care insurance. And for those kinds of insurance, the company can say, we want you to have testing, or they may say, have you ever had testing and what are the results? And they can say, based on that, no, we're not going to give you insurance.
And you also write that there are some drawbacks to DNA tests for children.
Yes.
With current technology, is it possible to tell which genomic mutations would cause diseases and which one would not?
No, alas. You can walk around with a mutation that kills someone else and you're just fine with it. There's so much variability. But our understanding of it, according to Dr. Schmidt, the NIH Institute, and others, is that our ability to interpret the genome is going to advance very rapidly. You know, the ethical issues for children are different than for adults. As Bob was saying, for adults you can work out guidelines for them and how to counsel them, but here you're speaking for the child.
And as we talked about during the Angelina Jolie incident, the adult could make the decision as to whether she wants to proceed in one direction or another. But a child is going to have those decisions made for it.
That is right. And many people are worried by that. They feel that that it might not benefit the child for all kinds of reasons. A colleague of Dr. Klitzmer's, Wendy Chung, Columbia, said inevitably it will affect the hopes and dreams of parents, whether they're conscious of it or not. So it's going to deeply color them and the children in their interaction. So every time the child coughs, they will worry.
Well, it seems to me that the people who will be most in support of this are the people in the direct-to-consumer genetic industry.
Oh, good. That's true. Bob,
yes, absolutely. There have been controversies. 23andMe, as you know and many people know, was barred by the FDA a few weeks ago from continuing to market its panel of tests that it said had medical implications because the company was not able to show medical implications.
They were selling it on Google, and it was $99 genetic test kit.
That's right.
Yes. And unfortunately, many of us think it was not accurate advertising to say it has medical implications because for most people it did not. But undoubtedly, there will be companies popping up saying, especially as the price continues to come down, we will now offer genetic test kits for infants as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we've seen in medical examiner's offices, often the lab work turns out to be inaccurate and people wind up going to jail because somebody misread the genetic information. So this is something that we would be labeling a kid with for the rest of its life.
And you think about the amount of information that is in the genome. If you had the most accurate medical test that we know of today, you would still have inaccuracies because it's just so much information. So what is a variation and what is an error that occurred in that sequencing test?
Haven't some established genomic companies like Illumina and Pacific Biosciences decided not to go into this area?
Do you mean into direct-to-consumers?
Yeah, especially for children.
Yes. Well, it's a bubble. The commercial area that's bubbling here right now and very hotly is in prenatal testing of mothers. Instead of using amniocentesis, because there is fetal blood in the mother, you can take a non-invasive blood draw and from that have genetic tests. And that is a very, very popular commercial area. And that's the for instance, Illumina has a company that does work there now.
My guests are Anne Eisenberg of the New York Times, Edward McCabe of the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, and also the March of Dimes, and Dr. Robert Klitzman, professor of clinical psychology, director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. Well, let's talk about amniocentesis. It's the test that is most often used, but it has certain drawbacks, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It can cause, for instance, miscarriage. And because it is an invasive test, it is relatively unpopular compared to what it is predicted there will be for a simple blood draw. And by the way, there's also now whole genome sequencing of the fetus, and there's whole exome sequencing of the fetus. That is still in the laboratory.
So we're talking about newborns, but these tests can also be extended to prenatal situations.
And to embryos in some cases. We have genetic testing of embryos before they're implanted in the mother. That is why the NIH has stepped in with newborn screening in the age of genomic information. It will take years and the wisdom of Solomon to figure it out.
Well, sure. Dr. McCabe, as the chief medical officer for the March of Dimes, which is an organization that describes itself as devoted to the health of mothers and their babies, how do you see the development of direct-to-consumer genetic testing?
Well, I think it's part of the autonomy that people say, this is my DNA. I have the right to know what my DNA is telling me about my future. The real problem with that is we know so little. We're learning a lot. We're learning more every day. But we don't know what all of those sequence variations mean in the DNA. And so saying that it doubles your risk or triples your risk of this disease, the absolute risk may still be quite low. So I think it's important that people understand the limits to the knowledge we have today.
Well, the FDA stepped in with the 23andMe situation, but does the government have much control over this area?
Well, this was with the FDA. They definitely have control, and they can say whether or not a test is doing what it's supposed to be doing. So I think that here they did step in. On a previous go-round, they had refused to step in, and they had said, this is just people with their curiosity. 23andMe said, we're not really giving out health information. It's really just satisfying an individual's curiosity about themselves. But this time the FDA said this is medical information. It's not grounded, in fact, and you cannot continue to provide this.
Dr. Klitzman, in a blog for the Huffington Post in September, you wrote that we're about to be hit with a tsunami of genomic information and we're utterly unprepared for it.
Yes, absolutely. I think, as was suggested, the cost is coming down. Just as to give people a point of reference, 11 years ago was the first time that the human genome was sequenced, and the cost of doing that for one person was $1 billion. Now, as Anne just mentioned, the cost is just a few thousand dollars. And so many, many more people are having this done, and companies are starting to come in. And the problem is that whereas a few years ago it was thought that we would find the alcohol gene, the cancer gene, the gay gene, the intelligence gene, the diabetes gene. Of course, we're finding out that genetics is far more complicated. There are many, many genes and other factors involved.
Just the genes and then the way they interact in the environment.
Yes.
Absolutely. So things are a mixture of nature and nurture.
But even with the price coming down, again, Angelina Jolie said that one of the reasons she had her surgery was because then it was $3,000 for the test. That was far beyond the reach of an awful lot of people. And even now, if I was concerned about, I wouldn't want to know my own genome. But if someone did, not everyone can afford $2,000 or $3,000.
Yes, and that's a major problem in that even with Obamacare, there are major questions about will genetic counseling be covered? If so, when? How much of it? Will the testing be covered? It may be the case, and even certainly when testing for things like embryos, that's something that insurance companies generally do not cover. And so there may be the situation where wealthy people could screen certain diseases out of their embryos and others can't.
And then there's the other aspect to the ethics going even with amniocentesis, and that is some people feel that if you find out that your child may have a problem, then you're going to have an abortion, and there is a big debate over whether abortion should be legal or not.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, where there may be some very serious debilitating diseases that a parent may say, look, my child won't live to be 2 years old, I'll abort the child. There's also going to be some things in the middle. So people are screening embryos for breast cancer, which won't affect children till they're 40 or 50, if ever.
Yes.
Of course, we also give newborns drops for gonorrhea, and that's not going to be a concern of theirs for quite a while, we would hope. My guests are Dr. Robert Klitzman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University, Dr. Edward McCabe, the physician-in-chief of the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, chief medical officer, The March of Dimes. Both of them have written books on this subject, and Anne Eisenberg of the New York Times, and she's the reason we're doing this, because we read your article, The Path to Reading a Newborn's DNA Map, and we thought that this was really something important to discuss, and we will continue discussing it after we take a little break. We are back with Anne Eisenberg, whose article in the Sunday Times was The Path to Reading a Newborn's DNA Map. Also with us is Dr. Edward McCabe, physician-in-chief of the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, chief medical officer at the March of Dimes, Dr. Robert Klitzman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. And Anne, your article appeared in the business section, not in the science section.
It's a big business, and a business that is going ahead very fast. Dr. Green from the National Institutes of Health's Genome Project said, we would certainly like to acquire data before the business comes upon us. It is a cutting-edge technology now, but behind it is a multi-billion-dollar business, and it will inevitably move its way into all kinds of testing and diagnosis.
Are people being trained to be able to read the genome accurately?
Well, yes, and also there are machines and software. It's more software programs that have to analyze it when you've got 3 billion chemical units or 1.5% of them, and then they have to be interpreted. A lot of that has got to be computer processed information. Did you want to talk about that, Bob?
Well, I just want to say that there's a severe shortage of genetic counselors in this country. There are only 1,800 genetic counselors in the whole country. Some of those are no longer working, some of those people, and it's because it's not been covered by insurance. But the notion that it's going to be easy to interpret is mistaken. It's going to be quite complicated to interpret things.
And I can imagine somebody misinterpreting some of that information, and then the person who has been told that this is going to happen lives a whole life in fear.
Right.
When is it going to hit? When am I going to have that stroke?
Absolutely.
Dr. McCabe, last month the U.S. Senate passed the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Reauthorization Act. I don't know how they come up with these names. What does that piece of legislation authorize?
Well, first of all, it is a reauthorization. So yeah. We've had this legislation for a number of years. It's important because we talked about how many tests are recommended. The federal government doesn't have jurisdiction because public health is state-based, but under the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Act, there is a group, the Secretary's Advisory Committee, that meets to look at what should be on the newborn screening panel. They recommend 31 disorders. They're considering another disorder. It's been recommended to the Secretary, a new disorder. But without this law, then we will be thrown back into chaos in every state on their own.
Well, what do you see as the prognosis here? We have had any number of pieces of legislation passed by the Senate and then rejected by the House. Are the people objecting to reauthorizing it?
The March of Dimes works very hard in Washington, D.C. and in every state capital in the union, really working to improve the lives of moms and babies. And we've been working very hard. Our group in Washington has been working very hard on that. They're hopeful. But as you say, no one knows exactly what will happen in the Congress these days. It has passed through the Senate, And things are moving in the right direction for the House to pass this also.
How many disorders do you think that we should screen newborns for?
Well, we support this recommended uniform screening panel at the March of Dimes. And so we would recommend that every state screen for these 31 disorders. And as additional are added, that will be the March of Dimes recommendation.
Go ahead, Ann.
If were we to have a genomic screening, we would go perhaps, it is said by Dr. Green, from two dozen to several hundred. That's a huge increase for people to handle and to understand.
Such as? What would some of the ones we can't test for now?
We can test for cystic fibrosis, but there are lots of studies showing that you could improve the diagnosis for the severity. This is with genomic screening, so you get much more information. Or there's infant death syndrome. There are certain cardiac patterns that are... This is all being done by the NIH. There are these grants that we're talking about now to see if we could – that would be something that we could add to the known disorders, the two dozen that we're already talking about. But, you know, it isn't just the known disorders with genomic or exomic screening. It's kind of what your colleague Wendy Chung called a timed release capsule because you get information that extends into the future. It's a question of how far into the future you want to read it or understand it. But once you have the genome – for instance, if a child has something that might be rickets, there's a genetic form of rickets, it shows up when the child is young, even before their bones are deformed. If you have a genetic hint of that, you can look for it, diagnose it, and take care of it. In other words, they are spared illness. There are many kinds of cancer that occur in childhood also for the same thing. So it's a time-release thing, sir.
But part of the problem with many of these illnesses is that we have no treatments for them. We would just simply be telling somebody, well... You're a time bomb.
I should have pointed that out. In the newborn screening program, the two dozen diseases that most states screen for have to be ones that there's something you can do about for it.
Yeah.
And the pediatrics group that Dr. McCabe would tell you about has also thought about this.
Yeah, there is the feeling among the American Academy of Pediatrics that unless you can do something by the time the child reaches 18 years of age and can make the decision for themselves, that there's really no reason to make that diagnosis. Another area...
Well, but 18 years old because in some cases you can't perform an operation when the child is too young?
Right. If you picked up that there was a mutation in the breast cancer 1 or breast cancer 2 gene, that's not going to impact that person and woman until she's in her 30s. We don't know of anything we can do now that would change the course of that disease, her risk of developing breast cancer, ovarian cancer, if we started before she was an adult. If there is something that could be done and an action that could be taken, then we would support getting the information out earlier. But another area that there's discussion about is in the area of drugs. We know that a lot of adverse drug reactions are caused by our genetics. Should that be tested in the newborn with the newborn screen? So that we would know that this baby should not get a certain kind of antibiotic that can cause hearing loss.
So it can cut both ways, you're saying. In that case, that would be a positive reason. In other cases, we could see negative reasons.
Yes, I think we need to look at what are the benefits to that child and think about the information that's useful for that family when that child is under 18 years of age.
It's interesting.
You want to add something, Dr. Kessler?
Yeah, this is a large area of controversy because the American College of Medical Genetics recently came out with recommendations that genomic testing done on anyone, including infants, include breast cancer. And they said that it would be important if the child's being tested because this way the parent would know, for instance, that the parent's at risk and that is in the best interest of the child. Many of us think that that's not necessarily a good idea, but these are issues being discussed out there and much debated.
My guests are Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University, Dr. Edward McCabe. Now, I've been saying that you're at UCLA. You've left UCLA.
Yes, yes.
And you're so diplomatic you didn't tell me that, but definitely at the March of Dimes. And Ann Eisenberg, you're still at the New York Times?
Yes, sir.
Ann Eisenberg's article, The Path to Reading a Newborn's DNA Map, was in the Sunday New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A lot of listeners have been writing in or calling us. By the way, our number is 212-433-9692. I'd like to read some of the questions that they've had. Amy from Manhattan wrote this on our show page. On the other end of the cost issue, would genetic testing lead to opportunities for prevention that would later save money in the healthcare system by keeping some of these diseases from developing and requiring more expensive treatment?
So, yes. So that's the idea of getting actionable disease testing for actionable things that we can prevent. The problem is that there are then these diseases that are sort of in the middle where you may have a double likelihood of getting the disease, but it's not treatable. But absolutely, the earlier we can do prevention in general in healthcare, the better off we all are.
And then Sydney from Manhattan called in to ask if new prenatal screening techniques will preclude the need for, chorionic villus sampling?
Which is like amniocentesis.
Yeah, it's CVS. I always get confused when I see the name, yes. That name and the pharmacy in the same sentence. But anyway, is it better than amnio?
So the story is that the testing work that Anne's article spoke about is after the child's born. So CVS and amnio is before the child's born, and one is hoping to pick up terrible diseases, and one could then terminate the pregnancy if that's what the parents wanted.
But we are talking also about the potential of testing fetuses, aren't we?
We are indeed. It's already been proven. It's been proven. And Stephen Quake is at Stanford. He's actually sequenced an exome of a fetus. So we have both a genome and an exome. It's all done. And we know how to do it now.
Well, how do we do it? I mean,
that's a very practical question.
How do you get the mother's, a cell out of a fetus?
The mother's blood carries quite a bit of fetal DNA, and you use it for the dad, you use saliva. And that's how it was done in these two cases. But your question is also related to amniocentesis. Because this blood is flowing through the mother, instead of using this a needle stuck into your stomach, you can have a simple drug. A blood draw, and that is why it is thought is going to become such a huge business. Bear in mind that in ultrasound, when it's been used in India and in China and in other places, it's led to women aborting fetuses that were female. I mean, so it's
which
real...
is causing a lot of trouble in China right now because the male to female rate of birth is so disproportionate that we're now seeing people of marriageable age not being able to find people they can marry.
I was just going to say, your question about how do they actually do it is an important one because it's being patented. And there are a few different groups that are busy discussing, shall we say, the patent issues of which technique is going to be the one that's patented and have the other people violated their technique, et cetera.
And patenting has become another big issue here, especially in connection with the BRCA 1 and 2. Where somebody has patented the test and it is incredibly expensive.
So and they've got the database too. Sorry, Dr. McCabe, that one's for you.
Well, there was a case and the patents have been severely limited compared to what they were before. And this is information. A lot of people don't understand, how can you patent my genes? You know, they're my genes. How can a company own them? And this is just a quirk of the patent law because you're not supposed to be able to patent a natural material. And many of us would think what's more natural than our DNA, but it has to do with the way the DNA is taken out of the body and sequenced.
And some people have said that at least they should have been informed that their DNA was being used, was being patented. Do you foresee a time when people will actually be paid a little stipend for the use of their gene?
Well, that's these are big issues at the moment. The feeling is that that would be hard to do. You would hope that companies that
I'd be willing to let them use my genes
for the right price.
Yes, right. Even a penny a test is okay.
Yes. That's right. You'd still be a very rich man. One hopes that companies that are making money off this, many of us feel at the expense of broad public health, would try to make whatever treatments and diagnoses be at an affordable cost.
A listener asks, won't this database of genetic conditions affect the future of these children? Employers will know of pre-existing genetic problems. I kind of asked that earlier, but that is a major concern, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah,
and Bob mentioned before about GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And I like to point out that I was a young man when the civil rights legislation was passed, and it's still being litigated. So while this legislation offers us protection, we don't know the degree of protection. We know some areas that it doesn't protect that Bob mentioned before. But even the areas that are supposedly protected, we're not sure exactly how far that protection will go.
John from New Jersey is wondering if infants can be tested for spinal muscular atrophy, which usually appears when the child is 2 to 3 years old.
Yes, you could, with this testing, you could identify those children. Could you provide a better quality of life, avoid diagnostic odysseys where they go from doctor to doctor till the diagnosis is made? That would be the primary benefit. We know we don't have a terribly good drug at this moment in time. So, yes, it would be possible, might prevent some heartache for the family knowing what's in front of them, but would it really allow them to take action and change the outcome? Not by that much, unfortunately, for that disorder.
Bob in Brooklyn asks, my wife has a debilitating genetic disease, and I'd like to test our daughter to see if she has a predisposition to this disease and see what preventative measures we can take. But I hesitate because I don't want her to be marked for the rest of her life. Is there any way to get a genetic test where the results are kept anonymous or private?
So people do get pay out of pocket for genetic tests, in which case only they will have the information. And this is important to be aware of. As I mentioned in my book, Am I My Genes, that came out last year, there's a lot of subtle discrimination goes on. And also in schools with children, it may be down the line that schools want to know, has your child had a genetic test? And if Johnny has some tests, we may not pay as much attention to Johnny, et cetera.
Who published your book?
It's Oxford University Press.
And who published your book, Dr. McKay?
University of California
and
Press.
And it's called?
DNA Promise and Peril.
You haven't written a book, have you?
No, I have not.
Well, it's coming, I'm sure. You wanted to say something?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that people do this testing anonymously. But if they read that small print on their health insurance policy or their life insurance policy, it often says if you have more information that you're not sharing with us, this is null and void. So that if the company finds that you did have that information, that's not going to protect you.
We've run out of time, but this has been a fascinating discussion, and I thank you so much. Well, you have one other thing you want to say, Anne?
No, it was fascinating. I agree.
My guests have been Dr. Edward McCabe of the March of Dimes, Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University, and Anne Eisenberg of the New York Times. And you should definitely try to read her article, The Path to Reading a Newborn's DNA Map. I think we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you all for having been on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Beautifully prepared. Yeah.